You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hi, this is Michael Silverblatt, and welcome to Bookworm. Today my guest is Robert Ward, the author of The King of Cards, a novel recently published by Pocket Books. He's the author as well of three other novels, Red Baker, Catalani and Little Breeches, and a first novel which was called Shedding Skin. And I thought that I would go on a circular route here, because this is a novel that's kind of set in the 60s,
right,
with a boy who learns to forge identity by inventing ID cards, laminating them and making it possible for other people to do things that they're not yet ready for.
Yes.
If one had to define the 60s in any way, I would like to suggest that it was a time when identities were forged almost in mass production, and that the people who received their new identities from the time were almost all of them unprepared to try a new personality on for size. Now, I know that you were very politically involved in the 60s. You were involved with the Diggers in San Francisco.
Right.
And I wondered if you'd talk a little bit about that.
Well, I think that's a smart comment about the ID cards and identity, because I always felt in those days that I was inventing myself on a daily basis almost, you know. I moved to Haight-Ashbury in 66 first, before everything was really geared up and the media had gotten there and all that. And I was stunned by what I found, because I was a kid from Baltimore who had started smoking pot and growing long hair probably a year and a half earlier. And in Baltimore, the scene was among hipsters, and they were much more hipsters than they were hippies. They were most of the guys I knew were quickly went from, say, pot to speed to heroin, and in a blink of an eye. And so I'd already seen things in Baltimore that were bad happening to guys. When I went out there, it was much more innocent, and there was a whole sense of hope, a sense of that people had found a new community based on sort of, based on a crazy quilt of Gandhi-esque principles and drugged-out principles and everything else. And it was stunning. I remember feeling this vast reservoir of hope even while I was still, a kid from Baltimore who was quite naturally cynical about all this stuff, because I'd already seen bad things happen to my friends who went that way. But the people out there were much hipper in terms of they were more open, they were ready to try things. And they quickly won me over in spite of my doubts.
I remember when I read your first novel, Shedding Skin, I felt and still feel that of a time which is relatively not represented still in fiction,
no,
if you wanted to point to people to what it felt like to be confused at that time. And I think that most good fiction is what it's like to feel confused at any given time. That writers are at their best in not imposing problems, but in illustrating significant confusion.
I think that's a very smart way of putting it. Unfortunately, true.
The Shedding Skin does seem to me to be a novel that you could give to a person to let them know what it felt like to feel confused and schizophrenic during that time, and the kind of aggression and energy that people had then. So the book has a kind of sadistic glee in the way in which it decomposes its hero.
That's true. It was sort of an anti. Although I never thought of it like this until after I wrote it. It turned out to be kind of an anti-Kerouac novel, where Kerouac goes across the world and United States and finds joy in all this. Bobby Ward, and I use my own name in it, for reasons I'm not sure about, goes across the world and has glee and joy, but he ends up becoming trashed and almost totally mad by the end of the book. And that pretty much is what happened to me, actually, when I made that scene out there. You know, I almost lost my mind. It was pretty harrowing by the end.
I'm curious about where it went, because, you know, there is something that interests me here, and it may not be your favorite subject, but you wrote Catalani and Little Britches, which is the only one of your books not to take place in Baltimore.
Right.
It was a movie, a book that, as I understood it, conceived to be in tandem with a movie.
Yes.
And you moved on into television. Was that part of feeling you'd come to the end of the crazy road and that you needed the possibility of life and support that commercial writing can give?
Yeah, well, I Red Baker came out, and
well, that's the return, it seems to me.
But I didn't work in TV till after Red Baker.
Mm-hmm.
And Red Baker, when I did Catalani, it struck me as a story that could possibly be commercial, but I also was taken by these little girls who joined this outlaw gang, and I saw them as sort of analogous to groupies from the 60s. And I saw their picture in a Western book. And when you think about it, if I'd have known anything about the commercial world, I probably would have never done it, because what could be less commercial in that era than a Western, which nobody wanted to make in the beginning, and then a Western starring little girls? You can imagine the unbelievable response I got from agents who said things like, "Excuse me, can you make them guys?" One guy actually said to me, "Can you make them guys, Bobby? You know, sweetie." And then he said, "And also, this Western thing, man, you know, that's a drag. Could you put them in outer space?" And so by the end of the conversation, I had them in outer space and they were guys. After Red Baker, though, I was exhausted both mentally and physically. I was so burned down. It took me 5 years to write it. It was turned down 21 times by 21 publishers with cynical lines like, a guy called me up once and said, "I'd love to publish this, but it's too much about working class people. No one cares about them, and and the middle class doesn't care about them, and so they won't buy it. And working class people themselves don't read, so they won't buy it. So who will buy it? No one." And he said, "If you'd also made it more sentimental, like the Waltons, if you'd have made it sweet and nice, but you have Red Baker, an out of work steelworker, cheating on his wife, and you can't have that." I said, "Well, you know, middle class people cheat on their wives, and we allow that." And he said, "Yes, but we hold the working class to a higher degree of morality than we hold ourselves."
Wait. I don't believe that this conversation took place, because most people who think this way in publishing would be ashamed to say it.
He said it. I swear to you, I won't say who said it, but you know his name. He called me to tell me this. I thought he was calling me to tell me he was buying the book. The conversation started with, "Hi, this is X." "Oh, really?" And here I am, broke, desperate. "I read your book. It made me cry." "Oh, really? Maybe you're going to publish it, you know?" It's feeling like I'm sliding off of a hill, you know, saying this. And he says, "Publish it." "No, I can't publish it." And by the end of it, he said all the things I just said. And by the end, he said, "Well, the real reason I called is I think you'd really have a lot of talent as a true crime writer, because you're a gritty writer. And why don't you come up and we'll talk about true crime books you might do for me?" And I said, "Well, you know, I'm not interested in doing that, you know?" And he said, "Well, you really ought to, because you'd be good at it and you can make a lot of money." And of course, I didn't bother to do it. But finally, it was published. And when it was published, I really felt desperately broke and exhausted physically. And I just thought, I have to do something to make some. I had no money, literally nothing. And my agent at the time said, "Would you like to work in TV?" And I said, "I don't even watch TV. What would I do in TV?" And she said, "Well, how about Hill Street Blues?" And that was the one thing I watched. And I did like it, and I respected it, because I thought they did really good work. And I said, "Yeah, well, that would be something I could think about doing, but what's the chances of me getting on Hill Street Blues?" And she said, "Well, we'll see." And she got the book, and I'd written a script of Red Baker by that time, and it wasn't going anywhere. But they liked it enough to give me a tryout to write a show, and I ended up on the show for 2 years. So I did feel that it would give me a chance to have some kind of life, you know, because I was already 40, and the thought of becoming 50 and going to Jan Winter and asking if I could interview Metalhead or something, you know, was a pretty scary thought, because I'd left academia a long time ago, and where was I going to go, you know? It was a scary time.
It's a very interesting question to me. And I think that indirectly we're talking about King of Cards.
We are? All right.
No, because, you know, I think that one of King of Cards is a kind of rite of passage novel. Rite of passage novels ask implicitly the question, how are you going to spend your life?
Right.
And how do you get there? And in the process of getting there, what is it that gets you over the impossible stile that keeps you between yourself and what you want?
Yes.
You know, how does subject join object? How do you leap over that fence? Anyone who, I think, has ever loved to read more than they've liked to be outside, anyone who's ever picked up a pencil and liked to draw right. more than they liked to be in the world hammering nails, has had the terrible knowledge that they are being held back from their lives by something that they don't know how to conquer.
Yes.
The solution always begins with a kind of spirited lying, you
yes.
know, which is where, in a sense, the King of Cards begins. Do you want to?
That's true. That's true. And what a route we took to get there. No, but
it's always interesting to go around the woods.
I agree. I mean, we don't have to go in a straight line. No, that's true. The book is very much about that. It's about a kid who was from a lower middle class family in Baltimore, and whose dad is what we would call obsessive compulsive now, spends 6 hours a day in the bathroom washing himself, which is based on my dad. He did that all his life, and it was at the time we knew nothing about it. We knew, you know, we just thought he was nuts, but in a kind of selfish way. We didn't realize there was probably some ganglia in the brain causing this, as they've now discovered. And my mother was sort of a martyr to everything, and when I went off to school, I did meet a teacher, just like Tommy Fallon does, who taught me that there was a finer world, you know. And I'd already loved books, but this world was the world of aristocratic England, and was Henry James's world. Mm-hmm. And I, the idea that I would become Henry James is absurd. But in fact, there was a point in which not only myself but several of my friends began to talk and act like what we imagined Henry James would talk and act like, and we tried to become refined gentlemen, as it were. And the things we really related to were probably closer to Nelson Algren and Jack Kerouac and things like that. But we didn't want to relate to those things anymore, because the teachers we had told us that they were the great unwashed, and the people they wrote about were the great unwashed. And after all, the people they wrote about really didn't have much mind and much capability of having mind. And so you want to go with the people who have the great ironic sensibilities and all that. And Henry James was, at that point, the master of all that and the god of all that. And so we very much liked it. And then at the same time, I moved into a house with a guy named Jesse Rossman, who you may remember. I think we may have met him many years ago when I knew you in Baltimore briefly. Jesse was a madman and a scamster. And his worldview was precisely the opposite of my professor's. And his worldview was that's all very nice, what the teacher's telling you, but in fact the world is a grubby, terrible place on the one hand, and can be transformed by you completely on the other. And you make the rules yourself. And this idea of sort of toadying up to Henry James or anybody from the past was completely useless. And what we should do now is reinvent the world now with us as the masters of it. And that struck me as a equally forceful lesson. So Bobby is sort of schizophrenic between one day trying to be this Jamesian fop and the other day becoming this total scam artist with his buddy. That's what the book is about. And I think you're right. There's a tremendous amount of lying and sort of self-invention going on at every second in it.
It's interesting. You say Bobby, the hero here is named Tommy, but to some extent you've been doing the adventures of Bobby.
It was a Freudian slip. Yes. Well, in a sense, this is a very autobiographical book. And I tried to write it right after the events that were sort of the germ of it ended, and I couldn't do it. You know, I couldn't write. I wrote it probably 10 times over the last 20 years, various 100-page segments of it, and threw them in the trash because I didn't see what they meant. You know, I couldn't see what they meant. All I could have were anecdotes, you know. The time this happened, that was wild, you know.
Uh-huh.
And I could tell them in bars and knock people out, and they'd say, "You got to write that." But I couldn't write it. I'd go home, and I didn't have any distance on it. I didn't understand what the events meant, and I didn't understand the sadness behind them. I don't think I wanted to engage the sadness behind a lot of the stuff, too. It was too painful to get into. So I kept it on the level of frolic and fun, you know. But that's not where fiction lives, you know.
So this is one of those books. Do you feel, having done it a bunch of times, that this is the version you wanted of that material?
Yeah, I do. I feel like I've got it. I mean, there are things in it that that I don't think are perfect, you know, that still bother me. But I feel that way about everything in all my books, you know. There are things in it that that I might change again, but that's how I always am. I mean, my attitude basically is I could take all my books and rewrite them all again and make them all better. But they might not be better for that.
Well, that's not what I mean exactly. I mean that I guess I think that telling a story is some process where you find the way for the story to tell what you want it to tell. Not getting the story right, but you know, it's tricky to try and define this. But there are some writers, James, for instance, is one of them, who's told the same story over and over and over and over again, mostly because the version he's told last is not the version he has to tell now. It's partially a feeling of not quite having inflected it right.
Yes.
And, you know, I think in a certain way in your work, the loss of innocence has to happen over and over and over.
Oh, God, I hope not. I hope not. But I mean, I think you're right. All my books end up being about... Barry Hannon and I were in discussion about my books one day, and he said, you realize in all your books, there's somebody learning something and somebody who becomes a sort of father figure who blows his mind completely. And they end up having this kind of friendship that ends up in destruction. Even in Cattle Annie, which was more of a commercial attempt, it really ends up being about two people whose friendship goes down the tubes because Cattle Annie becomes more ambitious for celebrityhood than Little Britches. Cattle Annie becomes so ambitious about being a celebrity that she doesn't even care if she dies in a bank robbery. And Little Britches, who thinks they're going to be friends for life, says, hold on, wait a minute. I want to jump off the train here if we're going to die, thank you. But Cattle Annie would rather die than give up that power and that desire for power. And they're both orphans and they're both poor. And I think that struck me as something that I could emotionally identify with too. So I think that's true in this book too, that Rains starts out as an innocent con man. And by the time the book is ended, who's no longer innocent, and neither is Tommy Fallon, and they've gone on a journey that's gone from being high-spirited fun to very dark, and that happens in all my books, and I feel that you're right. Probably this is a theme that it keeps coming back, and I sometimes we even consciously say this time I'm not going to write about that stuff. It's hopeless.
Well, you know, it's there even in Tommy's mother, who, out of lovelessness, enters the Miss Kissable Lips contest.
Right.
And you know, there... You see, you used a phrase that is sort of a catchphrase for me. I remember at a certain point that I would tell the people that I felt closest to that we were going to be friends for life.
Absolutely, yeah.
And, you know, I think because I believed in things like Friends for Life,
right,
I was always lying. Because, you know, if you want to keep a friend for life, you can't really tell them very much. You know, if things go wrong, you keep confecting a scenario which contains your friend for life in it all the time. And you can't quite tear up very much or get very destroyed because the friendship goes with it. And of course, when you practice this dishonesty as a systematic thing,
right?
Well, nothing stays around very long because, you know, lies have a way of being extremely temporary, you know?
Yes, that's true. That's true.
I somehow think that fiction begins in the place where ideals end, that you have to give up all the things that you've been taught to look at as goals, like friends for life or fame and fortune or all of the banner words that somehow or other fiction, the need to write fiction begins in defeat.
That's a terrifying thought, but I think you're right. The Nelson Algren said once that, as they said, why did you write? And he said, I write because the world presses in on you and you want to press back, you know. I think that's true. I don't think I could have written this book. The reason I couldn't write it when I was younger is I still believed in all these myths that my friends and I had constructed about ourselves. And they were all fictions, really. They were fictions we had to have to get through the day in those days, but they were fictions. And at the time, we would not certainly have recognized them as such. We would, if anybody had told us we were creating lies to sustain us, we would have been furious and said, well, you have no idea, you're square, you know nothing. But in fact, they were fictions. However, at the time, they were useful fictions. And to recognize them later as that is the loss of innocence. When you see what they really were, of course, it means you're beyond them and that they no longer serve you. But at the same time, the love that I had for those guys informs this book. And I think that was real, whether part of it was fake or not. Of course it was. Because we were adolescents too, but the truth is, that my love for those guys is just as strong today as it was then. You know, I really miss them, and I'm still friends with some of the guys that were in that scene. You know, I saw them just recently at this little book tour, and they all came to the reading. These are guys who never have been to a poetry reading in their lives or any of that stuff. It meant nothing to them. They didn't know what it was even. One guy came in and left, and then he came back, and I said, "What happened?" He said, "Well, you were reading, man." He said, "I didn't know what to do."
I'm talking to Robert Ward, the author of The King of Cards, published recently by Pocket Books. I wonder why you've gone back to Baltimore as the source for your books.
I think because you don't know a place. You only know a couple of places in your life. I wish I was more like Graham Greene, who could sort of travel somewhere and then write about it, you know? Paul Theroux or somebody like that who can travel someplace and sort of soak it up and write about it as if he's lived there all his life. Maybe he's only lived there 6 months or something. To me, Baltimore is a place I know deeply, and it's a place that formed me. It's a very tough place, and provincial beyond belief, as you know, I think. It's a place where, you know.
No, during the years I lived there, I was never awake.
Oh, yes, I remember. It's a place that leaves its mark on you, and you can't forget it, and you can't forget the kind of friendships and deep feelings you had for the people there, and at the same time, you can't forget the unbelievable prejudices that the place lays on you. I mean, if you leave your neighborhood there and go to another neighborhood, people in the old neighborhood won't talk to you anymore, and it's still that way to some degree, you know. Oh, you live over there. Oh, well, we don't talk to those people, but it's only 3 blocks away. Mm-hmm. Well, so what? You know, that's... They're all communists over there. I mean, I'll tell you a funny story. When I did Red Baker, I went to do a signing in Baltimore. I had done a signing in Washington. It was very successful. All these people came. So now I go back to Baltimore. And, of course, I really wanted people in Baltimore to read the book. And I go with my kid, and we get there, and one person shows up in like 2 hours. She picks up Red Baker. She looks at it. She says, "Hey, this is a book about Baltimore." She says, "What neighborhood's it about?" And I said, "Dundalk." She said, "That's not my neighborhood." Put it down and walked out.
Well, it really was true. It was sort of, more than any place I've ever been, a kind of checkerboard, and neighborhoods were around 2 blocks big. I think they formed around industries, and then the industries shut down or something.
Yes.
But you would walk. I went to Johns Hopkins in graduate school very briefly, and lived near the Peabody Institute.
Wonderful place to live.
And I didn't drive, so I used to walk back and forth or take the bus. You didn't really want to hitchhike in Baltimore,
no.
Although those were still hitchhiking days. And you would pass through so many shifts of mood.
That's right.
It really was amazing. It would be interesting to try and imagine a prose style that changed as often as Baltimore neighborhoods do.
No, it's totally true. It's totally true. And it's so it's a unique place. It's a tough place, and it leaves its mark on you. I have my new book that I'm writing now. I'm daring to write about something else. I'm writing about California because I've been here 8 years now, and I feel like I can maybe write about it. And I'm having a tremendous amount of fun writing about it because I have soaked stuff up about here, which surprises me, you know. And my added, I do have now sort of learned prejudices about the Valley and about Hollywood and about various parts of L.A. that are coming out in this book, and it's great fun to write about something else. So hopefully, I would never leave Baltimore behind completely as a subject matter, but I do want to try to take on other things. You know,
is the new one a comic novel?
You know, it's a thriller, but there's a lot of comedy in it, and I really find it being. I have to constantly rein in the humor in it, you know, because it has to have certain kinds of suspense elements in it. And I'm afraid if it becomes too ridiculous or too funny, it'll become something, some horrible hybrid. So I have to be careful as I write it.
Oh, that's so funny, because I always thought that thrillers and farces were exactly the same. It's just that in a thriller, you put in a couple of mean Joes with tough mugs and horrible weapons and sadistic impulses.
Right.
But everyone's just running around.
That's right. Well, hopefully I can do better than that. I really want to try to make this thing a real book. And I'm working hard on it. But I'm also using a lot in the new book. I lived in Arkansas for a couple of years, and I'm using quite a bit of the Arkansas stuff that I've tried to use in books over the years and never been able to use. And that stuff's sort of coming out now for the first time in years. And that's a lot of fun, too. So there are going to be – and then there are a few references to Baltimore that I can't seem to – avoid.
So they'll, you know, the dribs and drabs will make their way, you know,
they will.
The way Saul Bellow said that it was as if someone had tipped the country and all the loose screws had rattled to Los Angeles.
Oh, God, it's true, isn't it? He's right. Although Chicago has more than its share, too. Come on.
Wherever you go, you find the detritus of wherever you've been.
That's very true.
It's the only thing I know.
Absolutely, horrifyingly true.
I've been talking to Robert Ward, the author of The King of Cards, recently published by Pocket Books. Thank you for being with us, Robert.
Thank you so much.
I call you Bob, too. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer today is Scott Fritz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books. To the land of ice and snow in books.
As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages, back to days of old when knights were bold and books.
Books, 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 books. Books. Books can be funny too.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme.
Now in the book of the mouse, pop.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.